World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. So, to the first of the three female veterans contributing their accounts to World War II in words, Elizabeth Annie, known as Betty, Plummer. She was posted to Brisbane as a teleprinter operator in the Women's Auxiliary Australian Air Force, a resourceful young woman who had grown up in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. You're a child of the 1920s, born in 1922.
22322.
22322, well done. In Katoomba, New South Wales.
Yeah.
All right. And what were your parents doing in Katoomba, New South Wales?
My father was a butcher.
He was a butcher there. Katoomba's quite a wealthy sort of place these days. Yeah, what was it like then?
Oh, very quiet. Yeah. I don't remember a lot about it because I was only five when we left there. So
right.
We left there in 1927 and my father's family lived all, they were all butchers and his sister had the butcher shop at Berrima and my father went and took that over and lived, and we lived in Berrima then.
So you moved to Berrima, B-R-R-I-M-A, mm-hmm. New South Wales. Famous town in many ways.
Yes, yes. It's had the oldest jail, the oldest hotel, and two of the oldest churches. The Anglican Church was the older one, and the Catholic Church was the next. And it was just a little hick town, bush town, but now it's a very commercialised tourist attraction. Now all the shops are turned into selling all the touristy things, you know, and all expensive.
But life was a bit hard because the Depression hit. And how did that affect your family?
Well, it affected Dad's business because money, people were scarce, but a lot of people on the dole and what have you. And my father was a softie and wouldn't say no to anybody. And the butcher's family were the poorest family in town.
Yes.
But we had a good life. We had no luxuries. We had a wooden stick out of the bush and a tennis ball to play with, or marbles, or hide and seek, or paper trail through the. We lived near a bush and we paper trail through the
good
bush.
Yeah. It's not far from Don Bradman country, is
no,
it?
No, Barrel. I went to Barrel High School.
Did you? Mm. Did you know the Don?
No. Actually, before. My brother, who was the POW, his wife. I think it was Don Bradman's grandson was married to one of her her daughters. So we were connected with the Bradmans. So the boys, Bob and his brother, used to think that was wonderful because they said they were connected with the Bradmans, you know.
So you were growing up in Berrima, famous colonial town in New South Wales. And tell me about the local school and what was it like going off with your slate and your satchel every day?
Well, we used to only, we had a property in one street and it went through to the next street where the school was, so we only had to walk up and probably duck home for lunch and that sort of thing. But there was two teacher school. The one teacher taught, the lady teacher taught first and second class, and the other teacher taught the third, fourth, fifth and sixth, and we were all in blocks down the big long room. He'd set us work and go down to third class, but if someone talked up there, he knew who was the one that was talking, and you got hit with the chalk or the blackboard cleaner or a crip on the knuckles and the cane if you didn't do the right thing. So,
girls as well?
Yeah, oh yes.
Really?
Yes, if you, we wouldn't have done the things to the teachers that the kids do now. Mm. We'd have been out, and he used to go home and had the house was right behind the school, and there was a window from the yard in the house into the school, and sometimes he'd have to go home for something or other, but you never knew when he was going to pop his head through the window there, so, you know. And we all had long desks with about eight of us at a desk, and the boys behind it, dick your plats in the inkwell.
Dipping your plats in the inkwell. Yeah. I've heard about that.
And as I say, if he was at the blackboard and you did anything wrong, you're likely to get hit with a blackboard cleaner, and it was a wood with a thing. There was no ifs and buts, and you'd get a crack across the knuckle with the edge, sharp edge of the ruler. There was no use going home and telling Mum and Dad, because you did, you probably got another hit from Mum and Dad for being bad at school. So
you were obviously a good school student, though, because your later career would suggest you were taught very well.
Yes. He was a very strict teacher, but a very good teacher.
What particular skills do you think you learned?
We learned to behave. I know that was one thing, but nothing in particular. I don't think I specialised in anything. I loved maths. I was
mental arithmetic.
Anything, but I wasn't the quickest. But I was usually right, because I was, as long as I could nut it out myself. I wasn't much good on remembering historical dates and things like that, but I could do anything.
And I guess in those days, late 1920s, early 1930s, how long did you stay at school? Because people left pretty young in those days.
Yeah, I went sixth class at public school, and then I went to Barrel High School for 3 years.
Right. So you were...
travelled into Barrel on a bus.
Okay. And then you did your leaving or something?
No,
like
I didn't
that?
Do the leaving. I did the intermediate certificate.
Intermediate.
And I left then and did a business course.
So you were, about 15 then?
Yeah, 15 when I left school, 16.
And where did you do the business course?
In Sydney.
Why?
And I left home then and went to live with relatives in Sydney, because there was no work up around Berrima, nothing there. So it was a case of... So that's when I went and lived with one of my aunties and did a business course for 12 months and then got my first job and went from there.
Okay, just go back a sec though, the country town and life in those days away from, shall we say, formal education, learning about life in general. What sort of recreation did you do? How did you amuse yourselves?
Well, we amused ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we played games and if it was raining, you played noughts and crosses or read books or did whatever. You had nothing, no gadgets to play with or nothing.
Hopscotch in the street.
In the street, yes, and walk. We used to, you know, we had to walk everywhere because we had no vehicle, and we were 6 miles from the nearest. Barrel and Moss Vale were the two nearest towns, and we were 6 miles from that, so we walked everywhere. And walked home from school a few times when I was doing the intermediate certificate. If it went through after the bus went, you walked the 6 miles home and...
Good on you.
Thought nothing of it. It was life, we had... Yeah.
But it can get a bit cold up in that high country,
too.
Oh,
very cold. I couldn't stand it now. I don't know how, because the frost would be lift the crust of the earth up, you know, and washing on the line, it'd be like the hard as this wall, the thing that was very... I couldn't live there now.
And Dad kept on with his business? He ran the butcher's
shop? He ran the butcher shop until... When my brother came back from... Like, he was a POW, and when he came home... He worked with Dad from then until Dad got too sick to work in the early 1950s, and my brother took the business over then and worked.
So you had one brother?
Two brothers.
Okay. Sisters?
One sister.
So one sister,
younger sister,
two brothers. Okay. And then the family of you living in Berrima, New South Wales. Then at 15, you went down to Sydney, stayed with relatives. Yep. And went to a business college. Where you learned what? What did you do?
Typing, shorthand and bookkeeping.
Right.
All those office.
Right.
Office things.
What about boyfriends, Betty?
In
those days?
No, I suppose. We used to go, when we were younger, from when I was, 13, we had a younger set. A chappie that lived opposite formed a younger set in the town, and used to have fortnightly dances, and my mother used to take me to those because Dad didn't dance.
Yeah.
Dad played, he was a euchre player.
Yeah.
And Mum used to take me, and of course you'd have the boy across the road, that across the other side of the hall, that you want that particular dance with or something like that, you know, and you always that pat and hope that they came with that thing. But I met my husband when I was, 6 million, I was at the Christmas time, and I turned 17 in the next March, so I was 16 and a half, 16 and three quarters. And we went on a picnic one day, and I went off with another cousin, and he went off with another cousin, but we came home together, sort of thing.
That's
and
lovely.
That was went on from there then.
First boyfriend, really?
And that was when I actually moved. I was living in Willoughby, and that was when I moved to Reedy Hill, because they lived at Plumpton, little part of Plumpton. They lived Reedy Hill, so. Uh-huh. and it continued on from there.
So you're at Secretarial College, you're boarding relatives at Willoughby, is that right?
Yes.
And at school, at college in Sydney city itself, learning all these skills. And we're coming up now, I suppose it's the Depression is over. You were able to get a job.
I got a job, yeah. That was in 1937, 1938. I got a job at a paper, in the office of a paper bag manufacturing company. And that was when they used to make the paper bags and print, you know, the things for the fruit shops and all that on the paper bags, and that was there. So that was my first job.
How much did it pay? Can you remember?
My top pay when I finished, I don't remember what I started with, but my top pay when I actually left and joined the Air Force was £3.16 a week, and that was top. That was over the award wage. That was the, we were rich.
5 days a week or Saturdays as well?
Mostly 5 days a week. Yeah. Sometimes I had to work on a Saturday, but it was mainly 5 days a week.
Up and down on the train?
Well, I used to train. I used to leave home when I first went to, wasn't about from Willoughby, but when I first went to Rita Hill to work to live, and I travelled into Sydney. I used to leave home at 6 o'clock in the morning and get home at 8 o'clock at night.
I was wondering about that because the man you married, I'm going to get his name down. Who's this? Your husband?
Well, you want his full name?
Yes.
Or Ross was, he was known as Ross, but his name was Walter Ross.
Walter Ross. Okay. And what I didn't get, of course, was your maiden name.
Bender. B-E-N-D-E-R.
Thank you.
Bender, but you can't break it.
This place bender me, isn't
my
it?
My mother used to say that she was always on a bender, you know, because you get on the bender, you have the drug, you know.
That's a good one. And so you, your first boyfriend was Walter Ross Plummer.
The only one.
And you met him on a picnic?
Yeah. He went to Burma with the auntie that I actually lived with, was a great friend of his mother's.
Yes.
And she used to go up to visit one of my aunties up in Burma, and this particular year they took Ross with them.
Right.
And that's how we actually met, so it was their fault.
Lovely. Okay, good. Family picnic with friends in the Burma region.
Along the river we went, about 2 or 3 miles along. Lovely. It was the Windjikarabi River ran through Burma, and we went up.
Well, the expression these days is you became an item.
That's right, that's right.
And his family lived out in Rudy Hill Way.
A little place called Plumpton.
Yes, okay. What were they doing there?
Poultry farm.
Poultry farm. And you moved there as well?
I lived to Rudy Hill, yes, so that we were, you know.
Close.
Yeah, from, or like, it'd be like, a bit like here in Middleton, sort of, or not in as far as Middleton.
Cool, we're in Middleton, yeah. And when did you get married?
In Brisbane.
Yes.
At St Luke's Anglican Church at Ekeban in Brisbane.
And what year was that?
1943.
Okay, well, we've jumped ahead a bit. So you were you boarding with a family in the Plumpton Hill area?
Yeah, I was boarding with an aunt.
And then travelling in on a long train, 6 o'clock in the morning, to your job?
12 o'clock at night, yeah.
Right.
And then I finally left there and got a job in Blacktown.
Yep.
Itself at a produce merchant in the office there, and that was where I was working when I joined up.
Okay. What about Ross's military service, though? What did he do?
Oh, he went in. He was a conscript, I suppose, like an age group thing. And he went in 1941 and came out at the end of the war. But he was spent most of his. He did went to New Guinea, and then he was in Borneo at the end of the.
What corps was he in? What unit?
He was in the 2nd 12th Field Regiment.
Right, artillery. Yes. Okay. He didn't, despite the poultry farm, it wasn't a protected occupation?
No, he was actually working in a plaster, you know, they used to make the fibre of plaster. Uh-huh. He worked in that, making that, and that was where he was working when he was there.
Okay. So, who enlisted first, you or him?
Him.
He went off to war, what, 1939, 40?
40, 41.
40, 41, okay. 2nd 12th Field Regiment.
Yep.
Yes, okay. And he went off to, I said, as you got married in Brisbane, he was posted up there, wasn't he?
No, he was actually at Gympie at that time.
Yep.
And that was before he was being sent away, and he was going away, and so he was supposed to get leave to come to go to Sydney for we were going to be married in Sydney. And 2 days before that, they cancelled his Sydney leave, but they'd granted him leave to Brisbane. Mm-hmm. So mad panic.
Yes.
But the sergeant in charge of my shift actually lived, her family lived at Ekeban, and they, the girls, all the girls in my, on my shift all got together and worked at, and I actually met the minister that married us the day before we were married. My husband met him the morning of the day we were married. And the girls at Grace's family place, they all got together and clubbed, and I don't know how they did it, because in those days you had to wait 12 months to get a wedding cake and things like that. They even had a wedding cake and organised the whole lot, and we were married at 6 o'clock on that night and had it. And they went to work. They managed to find, get a room for us in the hotel that had been taken over by the Americans that night. Ross got up at 3 o'clock in the morning, went and got the troop train, had to go back to the barracks, or back to the army thing.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they'd said that he could have leave to go to Sydney. So that caused the family, it took a bit of convincing the family in Sydney that it was all genuine.
Yes.
And they've managed to get me a seat on the troop train.
Right.
He went in the front carriage and I went on the back carriage, and that was how we spent there. And then I had 2 days in Sydney and came back, and then he drove a vehicle back to Brisbane, and I saw him for a couple of hours then, and that was it. He went over to, went to New Guinea then. So.
Married in uniform?
Yep.
He was?
Both of us, yeah.
You were in uniform too?
Yeah.
Ah, so. That's wonderful. Thank you. So he'd enlisted. Tell me about your enlisting then. When this occurred in 40...
Beginning of 43.
Early 43, 28th of January. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're working for this company. You got a job in Blacktown. The man you were going to marry, your fiancé, had enlisted.
Yep.
And you felt you should do the same. Good on you.
Yep. It was something that appealed to me, that it was different, and I probably would have gone into the army, only they didn't have a posting that I could, like they didn't have the teleprinter things and that.
Right.
There was nothing that I really wanted to do, so that was why I became Air Force, because I was the only Australian in the family that was Air Force, all everyone else has been Army. So
this is 43, and off you went, what, to Victoria Barracks? Or?
No, I went to Bradfield Park in Sydney. I did my rookies, six weeks rookie. And then I went to Melbourne to Laverton.
Yep.
Air Force, that's where I did my teleprinter course.
Right.
Then I was posted to Brisbane WT, and I was there until, I don't just remember the dates now, and I was posted to the Central Bureau, or CB, and they told everyone you were going to CB, so they thought you'd been confined to barracks.
Confined to barracks, yes.
But Central Bureau, and that was in that place there. That was where I worked with the Americans in high security.
I've got a wonderful photograph here we'll have a look at in a minute to describe on tape. But before that, you'd gone to specialist training at Laverton, that's correct, is it?
Yes, out of Melbourne.
Okay, and we've got to get this right, we've got to get the name right. It's the Women's Auxiliary Australian Air Force, WAAAF. Right.
Right,
we'll get that right.
Right, yeah.
And what particular training did you do then at Laverton? What were you
just a teleprinter.
Yep.
Training, learning the different signals, you know, all the different places, different units and whatever had their own particular signals, and you didn't have to learn them all off by heart, but I mean you learnt to work out what was what.
Okay. Did you have to learn codes, ciphers, this sort of thing as
not
well?
Really, no. We did sent a lot of codes and ciphers, but we didn't really have to learn the whole
So your job description, if you like, was that wireless telegraphy operator?
Teleprinter operator.
Teleprinter operator.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The wireless telegraphy was the
code. Yes. Okay. Teleprinter operator, and you managed to get the posting to Brisbane, which was terrific.
I didn't think it was very good because I spent my 21st birthday on a troop train ride travelling from Melbourne to Brisbane.
Right.
And I was supposed to, I had friends in the family, because when you were posted around, everyone knew somebody, so they'd give you an address so that you could visit when you were on leave or anything like that. And they'd arranged to give me a 21st birthday party, and the night before that all happened, I got a posting to Brisbane, so I was on the trip train then.
All right. Right. You married, brief honeymoon, husband off to war, went up to New Guinea.
New Guinea, right?
Okay. Borneo as well?
And he went to Borneo, finished up in Borneo, yes.
Yeah, pretty dangerous stuff.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Did he come out of it all right?
Yes. Affected like everyone, you know, they had their problems, but no, he came out of it all right, really. So, except for malaria, he had a very bad lot of malaria, and he was still getting malaria when he died at 66. So,
That's horrible the way that keeps coming back.
Yeah.
Now, I understand, now you've shown me this photograph of Ascot, which was the headquarters. So it's described in this image here is the Central Bureau comprising service personnel, Australia, United States, Britain, Canada, New Zealand. And it says that this establishment, which was in Brisbane, that's correct, is it?
Or Ascot, and north of Brisbane, yeah. Ascot, the suburb of Brisbane.
You were responsible for intercepting enemy radio messages. So this is pretty high-level stuff. And the plaque says here it made a decisive contribution to the Allied victory in the Pacific War. When you were at work there, secrecy must have been a critical factor. Was this impressed upon you that you...
Yes, we had to take up the oath that we wouldn't speak about anything that we saw all of them there with the...
Exactly.
And that, I think that was sort of something like 50 years or something that was supposed to be... to be honest, I'd forgotten that I'd taken the oath, but I never took. But we didn't. Our signals were all in code.
Yeah. Okay.
So that we didn't really know, except that you know, there was the chance that you might hear something in a conversation or something like that. So that we really didn't know what we were.
And what sort of shifts did you have? Could you describe that to me?
The day shift was 6 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Then we worked 3 o'clock till 11, and the night shift was 11 till 6.
Okay. And
that was 3 days each shift, and then we had 3 days off.
Yes, okay. Letters from home, did you get letters from your husband at all? Was that possible?
Very few, yes.
What was your state of mind, Betty?
You were, I suppose, tense all the time. You know, it was at the time of... wasn't a really happy... I mean, I enjoyed my time in the Air Force, but it wasn't a really what you'd call a really happy time. I mean, it was lonely at times, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you had your moments, and you didn't know what was happening, you know, because I had to worry my husband and my brother. He was 3 years. We didn't know whether he was dead or alive.
I think we better talk about him now, and then we'll go back, perhaps, to Ascot and your work there. Your brother's name was... the one who was a prisoner?
Arthur Bender.
Arthur, okay. What unit was he in?
He was the 2nd 18th.
2nd 18th?
Battalion, infantry.
2nd 18th infantry.
And my father was the 1st 18th.
Now, right... So 2nd 18th, and where was he captured?
In Singapore.
Yes.
Okay. Only a couple of days after they landed.
Right. And he went to Selarang Barracks and then Changi Jail, I suppose.
Yep.
That was it.
Yeah.
Didn't go on the railway?
No.
You heard nothing from him?
For 3 years. We didn't know. All Mum got was a letter missing in action.
So he could have been dead for all you knew.
For all we knew, yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Goodness me, yeah. Terrible time. Did you hold out? What degree of hope did you have that he had survived?
Well, you really hoped all the time, you know, that he'd be that he would come out of it. You know, and then you'd get different messages that come through about, you know, things that were happening. Well, not really messages, but there'd be news flash things about, you know, what was going on. And you just didn't know what was going on. We had no idea what was...
Because in some circumstances, I know that the Japanese did allow prisoners to write, like, 15 words on a card.
In the beginning, at the end, the first thing we got was a 15-letter. Okay, that was the first we heard that he was... knew that he was...
And that had been held back, of course, for a long time.
Well, yes.
And how did you find out about this? Did Mum ring you, or what happened?
Well, no phone then. We didn't have a phone or whatever. I just got a letter in the mail, so I probably heard, 3 or 4 days after they'd got the message with the
that Arthur was...
It was alive, yeah.
He was alive,
yeah.
Gosh.
But we didn't know what state he was in or whether he was...
Exactly.
You know, whether injured or whatever happened. And then they came back. He came back in October...
1945,
yeah. And we actually went to Ingleburn. But he'd been in Darwin then for quite a time. But when he came back, he wouldn't have known. He was just a skeleton, you know. Yes. And that was even after the time in Darwin, you know.
Exactly.
I'm not crying. I've got a watery
eye.
It's
all right. But I guess you shed a few tears when you saw him.
Oh, I did, yeah, yes, yeah. Well, it was such a relief, you know. Yeah. You just felt as if the world had been lifted off your shoulders. But
did he get over it?
Yeah, well, I mean, he literally was 97, but he wasn't a well man, and I mean, he had had lots of issues and things like that. But I think maybe his size helped him. You know, as Bob said, he was small and a bit, you know, nuggety, and I think that probably helped him.
He'd been a jockey before.
He'd been a jockey, yes.
Yes.
So.
Right. So he came back, and you had a reunion at Ingleburn. But let's go back to your own life in the war, and I'm told that you were on the staff of the Allied Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Forces, is that the correct expression?
Yeah.
General Blamey's. General Blamey was the commander of the Allied Land Forces, Southwest Pacific. Did you get to meet the general?
No.
But this, I'm talking about, this is the right unit, I've got have I? So Ascot, here, the name of the centre, it's just called Central Bureau Headquarters.
Yeah, well, it was 21 Henry Street, we knew it as, because that was the address, but it was Central Bureau Headquarters, yes, yeah.
Central Bureau Headquarters of the Allied Land Forces.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's... Fine, I want to get that right for the record. It's important we get that right. Did you get any rank out of this?
No.
So you was...
No, I was just an ACW.
ACW?
Aircraft woman, yeah.
That's all right.
That was me.
Happy with that.
You're happy with that, yeah.
Apart from being a teleprinter operator, did you have to fulfil any other duties at all?
No, we were reasonably lucky in that we didn't have to go on parades because we were at shift work.
Yes.
Well, the only time I had to go on parade was... when I was in Melbourne on doing my course, and we didn't have to go on parade then, but then they brought in one day that everyone had to go on parade, and we'd only just come off midnight shift and it was freezing cold, and I'd just gone to bed when I was told that we had to be up and go, so we had full overalls, you know, the whole works, and so I pulled them in. We didn't have to dress, so I pulled those on over my PJs.
Yes.
Got out on the parade down, I had about that much pyjama leg showing below, so I'm sure I hit that up before we had the inspection from them. I managed to get away with that one, otherwise I might have been put on a charge or something for being incorrectly dressed, but anyway.
Back at that time you were training at Laverton, even when you went up to Brisbane, there was fear of a Japanese invasion?
Yep.
Well, tell me back to those days. Describe it to me, the sentiments.
Well, like I was in Sydney when the submarines went. But then we actually didn't know anything about it because we were out with Blacktown, away from the suburbs and that sort of thing. But Brisbane was a hotshot place because that was where most of the Americans were stationed and that sort of thing. So that was one place that they were on alert all the time for...
Yes.
For that, and I guess it was just part of living. We just, you know, we had to get on with it. A bit like now with the terrorists, you've got to just, you had to live, sort of thing, you know.
Sure.
But it was Brisbane was Brisbane and Sydney were the main target things, I think. But Brisbane was practically more Americans than Australians at that stage.
I should ask you about that. Can you describe some of the things you saw in Brisbane with the American troops?
Well, it was a few wild things went on there with the things, and a lot of the girls got into trouble with the Americans there with the thing, but I was a married lady.
You're
so
a married lady, but
yeah.
You mean
and,
they...
there was no appeal to me. The Americans... They weren't weren't men like our Australian men. You know, I can't describe what I mean by that there, but it was just different. There was, as far as I'm concerned, even if I'd been fancy free, there was no appeal to me. And I mean, and some of the stories we heard, and I, as I said, I went in quite a naive country girl, but I had my eyes opened with the.
Were they show off too
much? Well, they showed off too much and too much money. Tears were passed around too much money, you know, and the silk stockings and the cigarettes and the gay, you know, took them out for where our boys had virtually nothing, and most they could do was take you to the picture sort of thing, you know, so that it was just a different. It was more the worldly goods than the attraction of the men, I think, because. But you know, they weren't manly men to me. They weren't. There was no appeal, no. So that I wouldn't have finished up with the Yanks. So.
You had to knock them back. So I'm a married lady, did you?
Not really. I did. My girlfriend and I, we used to just go off and we used to go to the, you know, the dances at the Toc H, and that. But that was all our only Australian boys that went there, sort of thing. And you know, even though I was married, we still had to have a life, but you just go and dance with anyone that was there and go home. The two of us used to just go back to barracks together and that sort of thing and just live there.
Right. She was married too?
No. She was a Brisbane girl.
Yes. Okay.
But I had lots of drop-ins. Like it was, the joke was that I had umpteen boys came and saw me at the barracks, but none of them was my husband. He didn't get down much, but he was in with different fellows, and then the different ones that we knew from home that were up there, if they were going through on transit or something like that, they'd come and see you, and you know, I'd go to the pictures or something like that.
Gotcha.
So that was so. But it was just a joke, you know, that if anyone came to see you, the girls in the office would call your name and you'd go down, you know, and they'd all say, is it him? No, that wasn't him. So that, I think they thought he was a myth until he came down.
Tremendous, incredible times, remarkable period in our history. The job itself, you said you'd do a shift, what, 3 days?
3 days on and three days off. We'd do 6 days.
Yep.
6 days work and then you'd have 3 days off.
With an occasional dance at the Toc H and out of the movies, that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
okay.
Or if you were on midnight shift, you'd come home and you'd have 2 or 3 hours sleep in the morning, and then you'd get up and do your washing or do whatever and go out and have a coffee or whatever you did, and then you'd go straight to work. We pushed ourselves pretty hard, I guess, with the, but it was one of those times that if you went home and had a sleep, you woke up miserable when you went to work at 11 o'clock, so that was easier to keep go through, you know.
And then you stayed at that until, let's go to the end of the war now. You were discharged from the forces in June 1945. Tell me about that. Did you have to apply to leave? What did you want to do?
Well, it was coming, things were winding down a bit then, and we'd given the thing, and because I was married, I was able to apply to get out early, which, you know, so I got out a few months early before the war.
The war in Europe was over, but in Japan it lasted until August 1945. August 1945. You still didn't know about your brother? So still there was a bit of tension in the air.
Yes. And then, of course, you know, we didn't know when my husband was going to come home, you know.
Exactly.
We had nothing, there was nothing there till we...
So what came first? Your husband came back to Australia?
No, my brother came home.
Your brother came home
before my husband, yeah.
Okay.
He came home in the October. And my husband came home in the December, I think,
So you'd had the reunion at Ingleburn with your brother. Then Ross came back in December of 45. And where did he come to then?
He came to Blacktown, to Plumpton, to his mother.
Yes.
But in that time, we decided he wanted a poultry farm sort of thing. So we'd... And I worked for a produce merchant, so that he sort of was into things. And he actually put us onto a place of people that were selling. And that sale was actually... we decided to. His father, Ross left it to me and his father and mother, and we decided that was the place. So that was sort of in the process of going through. But in those days, it took 6 months for a sale like that to go through. So he got home, and then we actually moved onto the farm in the March. So he was home for that last 3 months.
So about March 46, you began your poultry farm at Plumpton.
Blacktown. Yeah.
I've got to tell you, I had a friend who ran a poultry farm just out of Bendigo. I thought it was incredibly hard work.
It was. It was hard and it was hot. You know, we'd be out there with the weather, 100 degree days, and I used to ride a pushbike 5 miles into town to do my shopping, and I wouldn't buy a trip of ice cream because you mightn't have enough money at the month end of the month to pay the feed bill and that sort of thing, you know. So, and we had no transport, so it was just life on the farm. And then I had the two little boys, so between little boys and chooks and whatever, it was a busy life.
Looking after chooks in large numbers, the injections and all that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Because people say chooks are no problem.
No.
Two or three chooks in the backyard aren't any problem. When you've got, they'd get chicken pox and they'd get something or other else and something, and they'd have to, and then there was a hailstorm would come and kill, knock them, the noise in the shed would hunt them out, and they'd get hit with hailstorms and die. We lost hundreds of chooks in one hailstorm one time, you know, and that sort of thing. And
how many did you run at any one time then?
We had about 6,000, I suppose.
6,000? Gracious me.
So little chickens and little chooks and big chooks, and you had to teach them to perch because they'd all go to a... You think the chooks are birds just perch, but when they're, you know, going 6 weeks old, 7 weeks old, you'd have to go out and make sure that they weren't, you know, in a huddle in the corner to keep warm and that sort of thing. And then the foxes would come in and get them, and the crows would come and take them when they were little chickens, so it wasn't all hay.
Hard work, and riding the bike to do your shopping.
Yeah.
And bringing everything back on the bike.
On the bike, yeah, with the...
And two little boys.
Yeah.
And one is now president of the RSL.
That's right.
Yeah, Bob. And the other boy?
The other boy's, well, he's retired at them now, but when my husband, after the poultry farm was sold and whatever, my husband went into partnership with his brother with the truck.
Right.
And Peter took that over then, working for the blue metal and gravel company.
Peter's the other boy.
The other boy, yeah.
Thank you. Okay. So you ran the poultry farm. For how many years did you do that?
About 1955, I think, was when it started to tail down. Like, things were getting too complicated. Like, we had the egg board and you had all the different things coming in and whatever. And then we had... This was really hard to take. We had a letter from the... There was only three houses in our street. And it was just a dirt track. And our mail used to be delivered to the end of the street, so I went down this road in the rain to get the mail, and the letter from the housing commissioners was then saying that as from such and such a date, which was several weeks before the actual letter was dated, that they had taken over our property, and that we would be, from then on, we couldn't farm it or do anything with it, and we had to, and they would pay us their figure at the date that they decided. So that was a bit hard to take after what...
Compulsory acquisition.
So then, there again, I did a bit of a fill-in job with... he was a real estate agent, but he had a dry cleaning agency as well. Yes. And a friend of mine worked there, and if she was sick one day, I'd go in and he was, of course, in with the... There was a lot of housing development going on in those days. And he was in with a company that were doing developments, housing developments, and I don't know how they did it, but they were able, they pulled strings and whatever, and they actually bought our place. But then, because we didn't get what we figured, we had to take their figure. It was a case of taking their figure then, or waiting, whatever, and the property behind us that they took, the housing commission took, they waited 5 years to get their money for that land. So we took, it was the lesser of two evils. But also we did recoup a little bit because they had an investment thing that was paying quite good interest in, so we invested that money. So we made a little bit up that way, but it was a bit of a hard pill to swallow after.
Certainly. So the idea, the original notion, though, was that your property and adjoining properties would be compulsory acquired for public housing.
Okay. And there was my brother-in-law was in the same situation, and behind him, he had a poultry farm, my brother-in-law. But behind him was a market gardener, and they told him he wanted to plant tomatoes. and they told him he could plant the tomatoes, but he, they would charge him for the for using the land, and they hadn't paid for it, but they were going to charge him rent to plant his tomatoes if he wanted to. Yes. So
let's just go back to the war then and reflect on that a little bit more. You told me about the feeling about the Americans, concerns. We had the Brisbane Line, all that sort of thing, about Australia could defend, what it couldn't. What were your feelings about the Japanese? How did you view them as a nation?
Very bitter then at the time, but they're strangely enough, my brother, who we thought, as Bob was crazy, he was down here on with holidays with Bob one time, and they said about taking him out to dinner, and Bob said to Arthur, where would you like to go? And he said, a Japanese restaurant. And Bob said it was the last thing he'd expected. Yeah. But as my brother said, you can't blame these, it wasn't these.
No.
And there would have been a lot of Japanese that wouldn't have wanted to go war any more than a lot of ours wanted, you know, so that it was one of those things. And so that, you know, we got over, but at the time it was very bitter.
When did you... Can you remember when you first heard about Japanese atrocities?
Horrified.
Yes. Can you remember when that was? When did the news come through? How did you find out?
Well, we didn't really know the full extent of it until after the war.
I thought so.
Yeah. We didn't know the full extent of it until after the war. We had no idea, you know, how they were fed and what how they were treated until after it was all over, really.
And did your brother tell you about what they used to...
He wouldn't talk about it. Actually, I heard more from him and from Bob the weekend my husband died. They were there and that they had a few drinks and a few little bits and pieces come out there, but they wouldn't. He wouldn't talk about it. But at the end, like after when things settled down, he had no didn't hold anything against the Japanese, because as he said, you know, but now they had nothing to do with it, you know, everyone's now, and it's a bit like I had an instance just recently of someone whose father was killed in Vietnam, and they were at a function or somewhere or other, and there were a lot of Vietnamese people there. And this person was sort of saying, oh, I shouldn't have been here and they shouldn't have whatever. But you can't blame them now for what happened, you know, and that was the way that...
So your feelings about the Japanese today, what are they?
Well, no feelings about them at all now, because, you know, it's something that happened. And
then, of course, you can't get away from it because you've got your son Bob serving in Vietnam.
Yep.
Tell me about this, how this came about.
Well, as I said, the only lottery he ever won, and it was the wrong one.
Yes.
And he was born just after midnight, so as he said, if I'd done the right thing and had him before midnight, he wouldn't have been. So it was my fault.
He got called up.
Yeah.
1968. 1968. Infantry. 9 battalion.
9 battalion.
Okay. So you had to go through it all again.
All again. Yep.
Talk to me about that, how your feelings were.
Oh, that was bad. That was hard.
Hardest of the lot, was it?
Hardest of the lot, yeah. Because I felt we'd done enough. And the whole thing was so unfair. It was a war that should never have happened. And the way they did it, I mean, it was just, to me, all unfair. Maybe that's because my son was called up in it, I don't know. But it was just something that... It was very hard to take.
Peter wasn't called up?
No, Peter was lucky. His birthday didn't come up.
Bob was called up. Bob's birthday, what is that then?
The 12th of July.
12th of July.
1947.
Okay. So he was conscripted. Off he went. Vietnam for a year.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that was another worry because, there was more contact then than there was with the Second World War, but still there was still a worry with that. And it just wasn't a war to me. They were mates in the daytime and shooting them at night time sort of thing, you know, and it was just a war that should never have happened.
He's not with us right at the moment. He's gone out about his business. He's the president of the RSL here. Perhaps you can tell me, how was he when he came back?
He was probably one of the lucky ones.
Yeah.
He was with the bank, it was the Bank of New South Wales in those days, the old Westpac. And I had actually had a letter from the manager of the bank saying that his career wouldn't be affected by his. And when they came back, he had to do other training and that, but he could progressed in his career right through. And it was, so that really he was, in that respect, very lucky that he...
And so I'm told, he's got a very successful RSL here. The premises are superbly done up.
Yeah.
But when he came back to Australia as a Vietnam vet, how was he received? How was he welcomed?
Well, there again, because the bank actually looked after him and he didn't get involved, but I mean, he was never actually abused like a lot of them were. Yeah. And as he said, he'll tell you himself that he was one of the lucky ones actually, but the bank really did look after him. I'll give them that idea there, and he just continued on with his career. And they were married. They married before he went to Vietnam. So that, and Vicky's a great backstop for him. So that, I mean, he had his issues, and he still has his issues. He's got this nerve thing that they've all got with the thing, and he has his moments, and he loses his cool at times. Mm. But it's all. As I say, really, he was probably one of the lucky ones.
Okay, good.
But, I mean, it was the way that the majority of them were treated when they came back that was shocking. Mm. It wasn't their wish to go.
No.
It was the government that sent them, and it's all right for the government to do all these things when they haven't got to do the...
You've done your bit, haven't you, as a source of female comfort and direction for former servicemen, going right back, haven't you?
Yep.
You really have. You must understand the military mind very well. Do you think, what are your feelings? Should young men have some form of military service? Is it a good thing or not? What do you think?
I think conscription should never have been stopped.
Yes.
I think we wouldn't have half the problems that we've got now with the young ones if they'd had, I don't say send them to war, but give them that training, because a lot of them haven't got. The sad part about it was that I feel that the ones that were kept in the army, as Bob used to say, when they were the conscripts, if they played up, the army didn't want them, they put them out. Well, they were the ones that needed the discipline and the training and that. It was the ones that had discipline from home, and like Bob was in the Cubs and the Scouts and the whole thing and all that sort of thing. They'd had a lot, but the ones that hadn't had it and wouldn't conform were the ones that they didn't want. Well, I think conscription... I've got no problems with my younger son, but I think that the time in the army wouldn't have done the discipline.
Sure.
And respect, and that's the trouble with the world today. There's no respect, sadly.
Long connection with New South Wales, and then you moved to South Australia. Hmm. Why was this?
Okay. Well, it came a time, like my husband died, I've been on my own for 29 years now, and... I had a lovely little home, and where I lived was a beautiful spot. It was in Tupley in New South Wales, and we had the beach and the lake and the similar sort of atmosphere to this, I guess. But it was time that I knew it was coming time to make a decision that I wouldn't be able to cope, always. And I wanted to make the decision. I didn't want it to be the boys, so that whatever decided was belly up, it was my fault.
Okay.
So, and it was a case of... I don't really know. A case of what I could afford to do as well as what I wanted. And I mean, there was nothing near, and there was nothing where I lived, like in a retirement place, that I wanted to go to. There was nothing near Peter that I could afford to go to. It was here, and then to come down here was time with the family down here, where I'd had the time with the family up there sort of thing. So I split up, and I think they might have been glad to get rid of me from New South Wales. But so it was, that was a decision that was made, and it really worked out quite easily in the long run.
So, I'm not quite sure, was one of the boys down here? Is it
Bob was down here.
Bob was down here. He'd come down here.
Yeah, well, they came down in 78 with work, with his work, and they stayed down here. So they were happy.
Yes, sure. And this place in New South Wales, it's near Newcastle, isn't it?
Yeah, between Gosford and Newcastle.
T-O-U-K-L-E-Y. And I know about the lakes, so I remember
those.
Okay.
A lovely area, but then again, by what I hear about it now, it's not the lovely area that it used to be. Like, unfortunately, the bad element slips into everything, doesn't it?
Exactly. So you left the poultry farm, and it was another sort of business you were running up there with.
Well, my husband decided, he always said he wanted to retire when he was 50.
Right.
So he didn't quite make that, but we invested money and worked towards that goal. And then in 1971 was when he turned 50.
Yes.
And we'd done a lot of caravanning, like on holidays and things like that. And we decided that was the time to get out, and Peter was interested in taking over the business. So we went from the 70s, we toured around all around Australia. And then we did our itinerant work. I worked in canneries, climbed apple trees and picked apples and did all those sort of things and fell out of apple trees. And we lived on we didn't want to touch our capital because we knew that had to be our safeguard. But we lived in that itinerant work. There again, we worked 13, 14-hour shifts in the canneries and
Good
did all
on
that
you.
Sort
That's
of thing. And,
wonderful. And what sort of business had it been at Tookley that you were running?
We didn't do any. We retired.
Retired to Tookley. So after the poultry farm, you ran
a trucking
business. Yeah. Okay. And then you're talking about working around Australia in canneries. In Victoria?
No, New South Wales.
New South, okay.
Maid.
Okay.
Canary and... doing corn and things like
Done
that.
Some stuff.
Yes, with the,
and there was no call for a teleprinter operator anywhere.
No.
Now tell me, you were a professional communicator, right? Well, top gun at your job. What about communications these days? What do you like with that? What do you do?
Nothing.
Well, I thought, don't you do computing?
I do computing work, yeah, I do home with banking business and all the whatever, and type letters and play games and do all sorts of things.
An iPad?
Yeah.
Oh. One of those fancy smartphones?
No, I haven't got a fancy smartphone. No.
But you do all your banking online?
Send emails to all the family.
That's
and
marvellous.
Keep in touch with the kids and the great grandkids, and I've got 12 great grandchildren.
12 great grandchildren. So the two boys and then a number of grandchildren.
Well, I had two boys and Bob had two children.
Yes.
And Peter had four. Peter had a broken marriage, unfortunately. Yeah. He had four children. And out of that, I've got 12 great-grandchildren. Two of them are 19. So it doesn't do my ego much good.
That's... How many grandchildren? Can you remember?
I had six grandchildren.
Six grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Yeah. That's phenomenal. I suppose you've got to keep in touch with birthdays and...
Oh,
Skype? Do you do that?
Yep, Skype the grandkids. And I had a grandson, he's home now, but he worked in KL for quite a while, so it was good to Skype with him.
And you've been up there?
No, my travelling days are over now. So.
Where have you been?
Oh, I've been to England.
Yeah.
And I've been to New Zealand a couple of times, but that's all overseas. But my husband wasn't interested in overseas travelling. No. We've just been all around Australia, toured a caravan all around Australia and did all the usual things, all the silly things.
That's lovely. Yeah, tremendous person. Now, these days, you involved with the RSL a bit?
I come to the RSL, like with Bob and Vicky, and we get to do different things, but I'm too old to do much around the place now. I was very involved with Legacy and when I was in Sydney, but...
I think the final area I'd like to discuss with you is the legacy, your legacy of service. You had a very responsible job. You had to take an oath and the Secrecy Act, all that sort of stuff. What did the military life teach you? What was the legacy it left you?
Oh, that's very difficult. I guess it taught me to be self-reliant, and you had to make your decisions, and you had to think before you made a lot of decisions, and also comradeship, made some wonderful friends, And I saw the other side of life that I hadn't seen before. I mean, as I say, I was a pretty naive sort of country girl, and you suddenly realise that there's another life around what you knew. And it's made you to appreciate what we've got, you know. And makes me very sad to see the state we're in now today with the state of the world and everything today. It's rather a sad world we're living in, I think. But the fact that you can't, there's no respect, and you can't trust it. Who do you trust? I mean, we were brought up to trust everybody. My mum and dad wouldn't have known where the keys to the house were. And I've seen Dad come home with the money from the butcher shop and put it on the mantelshelf, and the house would be unlocked, and you never thought a thing about it. And now you think twice about even getting a tradesman to come to your house, you know, because you just don't. And that's sad. It's just sad. It makes me, you know, you just don't. And the young ones today, I know we've got some terrific young ones, but it's the, and sadly to me it's two or three generations now, and I can't see it getting any better because they've got no guidelines.
Thank you, Betty. It's a great honour talking to you. You've had a fascinating life. Think of the changes you've seen in life. They're astonishing.
Well, you know, we went back from the old wood stove with the kettle, the copper, you know, light the copper fire and poke it with the stick and do the thing. No washing machine, no wringer. I could wring the clothes by hand and everything. But we've got a lot of changes, but I still wouldn't change my life for all the young ones. I've got everything now and they're still bored.